Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dat-gum, dat-gum, dat-gum government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Uh-huh.
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Mike Gatti, a.k.a. the Rebel Madman. And he had to step away from his mic for just a minute, but he'll be back here shortly. I'm going to do something a little unusual tonight to start this show. We usually start it with a prayer. I think I'm going to bump the prayer off until the end of the show, but I'd just like to read you something. Some people will recognize this verse from Scripture as Hosea 4, the first six verses of it. Hear the word of Yahweh, you children of Israel, for Yahweh has a case against the inhabitants of the land, for there is no truth or kindness or knowledge of Elohim in the land. Swearing and lying and murdering and stealing and committing adultery have increased, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and everyone living there languishes, with the beast of the field and the birds of the Shamayim, that Shamayim is heaven, and the fish of the sea are taken away. However, let no one strive or reprove another, for your people are like those striving with a Kohen, that's a priest. And you shall stumble in the day, and the Navi shall also stumble with you in the night, and Navi is prophets. Stumble with you in the night, and I shall make your mother perish. Kind of like old folks in a nursing home. Perished for lack of knowledge, because you have rejected knowledge. I reject you from being Kohen for me, since you have forgotten the Torah of your Elohim. I have forgotten your children. There's a few things spoken there that seem quite prophetic to me. Mike, let me know when you're back.
I'm here.
Since Mike, there you are. I don't know if you heard me or not, but I just read the first six verses of Hosea, chapter 4.
Yeah, I heard
people are lost for lack of knowledge. It's funny how little things like that leap out at me when certain things happen or situations changes. In our life that didn't leap out at me before when I read that maybe several times in the past. Mike, I know that you're a little bit down in spirit, as most people are, because of all of the crazy, corrupt things that we are seeing around us today. And I think it's very appropriate that we are talking about the subject that we're going to get into tonight. And I hope people can draw the correlation to today, because we're actually living the end result of precisely what you're going to share with us tonight. So I'm going to give you the floor, my friend.
Well, Terry, thank you so much. It's crazy times. So I'm kind of glad we're going in a different direction and dropping back 160 years or so and taking a look at some events that to me are very relevant to where we are today, especially as we're beginning to hear a lot of talk with the S word, secession. We're beginning to hear a lot of talk with that. Texas started immediately after their case was They were told they had no standing in America by the Supreme Court. And we're hearing a lot of other people, and, you know, even as you and I both know, a county in Colorado is talking about this. And so looking back at the events that led up to what is mistakenly known as the Civil War, and every time I think of it, I think of this beautiful lady in Georgia that I met many years ago, and we were a well-refined Southern lady, and we were sitting around in a discussion, and one of her grandchildren, she asked one of her grandchildren, says, what are you studying in school? And her grandson said, well, Grandma, we are just starting on the Civil War. And this wonderful lady, and I mimic her from time to time, she said, son, it is not the Civil War. It is the War of Northern Aggression. So I think about that sweet lady, God rest her soul, so many times when I think of it. And I like what Stonewall Jackson called it better than any other term, and he called it America's Second War for Independence. And probably no event in our history has been written about more. You know, I forgot how many books have been written about Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, of course, we've got so many characters that were involved in that war and so many things that go on about it. But to me, you know, being something of a historian, to me, I have found that if you look at war, there is one thing that is always prevalent, and that's the old follow the money. And wars are fought over money. And they all wars are about money. You know, I don't think you can point up one that wasn't about money. And, you know, maybe property, as people call it, but it's still money. And, you know, one of the things years ago when I got to looking into this, one of the things that just really, really stuck out to me was when I found the existence of a young man, I think he was in his 20s, mid-20s at the time, a visitor to America who had come here from France, and his name was Solomon, S-A-L-O-M-O-N, James Rothschild. And he traveled for a year or more before the outbreak of the war, and he traveled quite extensively, north and south, and spent a lot of time going from place to place. And he sent at least 13 letters back to his uncle in France, who was a banker. Imagine that, a Rothschild banker. And but he talked many times of what he saw and what he witnessed. And there has been the idea put forth that perhaps that he was here and he was sending back information about the war. And as we get into this discussion, Terry, we're going to talk about something that most people have never heard of, and it's called the Hazard Circular. And we're also going to learn that that it has been denied, its existence has been denied on several occasions. People have said, no, 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 it didn't exist. Well, I actually have proof that it did, and it was actually published in a magazine in the 1870s. A copy of it was found and published in this magazine. So people can say, no, it didn't exist, all they want to, but the fact of it is that it did exist. And it fits perfectly into the history, because we know that when people, when despots go to war, and there are people out there that they are trying to convince the need for war, you know, lies ensue by, you know, by the bushel loads. And America is really good at that. I mean, you know, we can go back to you know, the babies being thrown out of incubators to lead to the first Gulf War, and we can go to weapons of mass destruction and allocate from Nigeria for the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, there's just, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident for Vietnam. The lies are resplendent. No matter where you go, there's a lot of lies that lead to war. So we will look into that and tonight and try to understand that in the context of the Hazard Circular. Of course, someone has to seize moral high ground, and it has to be done almost within a certain period of time. And when the war began and Lincoln made the invasion of the South, and people will say, well, there's Fort Sumter. Well, contained within Solomon James Rothschild's letters is a refutation of that being the first act of war committed. And he certainly, in his letters to his uncle in France, he puts the blame for the war squarely on Lincoln as for blockading southern ports and the invasion of Maryland prior to Fort Sumter being fired upon. So that gets to be quite a good discovery. But I was just thinking, Terry, let me read a little bit, if I may, from the last letter or the next to last letter of Solomon Rothschild. Well, I think it is actually the last one, pardon me, to his uncle in France. Actually, this one is, well, it's to his cousin in France. I'm sorry. And he says, you see then, my dear cousin, that it is a question of life and death for the North. It will make the greatest sacrifices and will yield nothing. It is unanimous on this matter. Republicans and Democrats are fighting side by side, but from a different point of view. The Republican, who, not through Negro-file philanthropy, but in order to give the whites a greater extent of territory, he told the truth, restricts the extension of slavery, wants to push the slaves back into the confines of the cotton states and to emancipate those of the central states. In the blindness of political passions, he believes himself strong enough to reach this goal. The Democrat fights for the reconstruction of the Union and for this reconstruction alone. He wants to give the South all possible concessions provided that it reenters the Union. He doesn't want to make a conquered country of the South, but he doesn't want to have to fear further danger from it. The question has become such an embittered one, the facts falsified to such an extent by those who find their advantages in the Civil War, that the two sections of the country do not know each other anymore and are completely unaware of their mutual intentions. And the farther they go, the less they will recognize them. Because of the immixture of party considerations, the point of departure will soon be forgotten. And as I have already seen, it all becomes a question of personalities and of self-esteem. I have traveled throughout the entire South, and I have found there a complete unanimity for secession. The more or less imaginary grievances against the North loom up larger and larger in the minds of the secessionists. And some very distinguished men, generally peaceful and calm, have told me that they would prefer to live under the liberal government of Louis Napoleon rather than to endure the unbearable oppression of the North. They say that they will fight to their last breath and will shed their last drop of blood and, what is most important, will spend their last cent. Besides, mediation by foreign powers will only aggravate the question. In the North, I have been told that if it is necessary, they will urge the slaves to insurrection and stir up a slave war in the South. You see, then, that it is a struggle which has no way out. With minds so determined and principles so opposed, reunion is impossible and secession is no less so. The North, with its 20 million inhabitants and much more money, will have the upper hand, but 8 million inhabitants can prolong the fight for many years. I see no possibility at all for a reconciliation, except through some entirely unforeseen event, which may be among the decrees of Providence. End of quote, or end of letter. So he is making that observation. And then in several of the other letters, he took the position of the South. And he blamed the North in these letters back to Europe. And at one, in one letter, he actually begs his his relatives, he begs them, if they would, to please find some way to side with the South. And so I'm trying to find that excerpt. He says, I don't think, my dear cousin, that I have written you in detail since my stay at New Orleans. Since then, I traversed the whole South, the West, and the North, and attentively observed the march of events. I came to the realization of the ideas prevalent in the different parts of the country. I succeeded in forming for myself an impartial judgment amidst the exaggerations of the two opposing sides. So we're listening to someone who is allegedly neutral here. Now the struggle has been entered into between the North and the South, a struggle of giants, or rather of bulldozers, in which no one will yield, and wherein, after months and perhaps years of implacable combat, the two sides will find themselves back at the very place from which they started, both of them weakened, with their resources totally exhausted, their country ruined, with the best of their blood sacrificed, with no other result obtained than deepening the abyss between them. The Constitution of the United States is such that a good lawyer can easily find the pro and the con in it. Yeah, right. That's for sure. The South claims that it has the right to secede. At New Orleans, the foreigner who listens to the arguments will be persuaded by them. The North affirms that the union of the states is an unassailable principle. If you return to New York, you will find that it is also is perfectly right. I am not going to discuss the problem from the legal point of view. I only want to give you an idea of the facts and my appreciation of the struggle which is going to break out. So he goes into great detail in this one, and this one towards the end, he says, the theory which is one of the prerogatives of absolute liberty was no danger to the existence of the federal government as long as each state was too weak to defend itself. And when the most complete union was necessary for defense against foreign invasion or internal enemies, as long as their interests seemed to be the same and the population had not obtained the development which it has now. Today, the southern states, which were enticed to utilize the money and the forces of the North for growth and preservation, find that their interests are no longer the same. So he goes into the slavery question, too. But here he says, I'll come back later to the slavery question, which was the first pretext for secession, but was just a pretext and is now secondary. The true reason which impelled the southern states to secede is the question of tariffs. The South is simply a producer and a consumer. The West and the North, and especially the East, are almost entirely manufacturers, but they need strong protection. The South could supply itself with all necessary items from Europe at prices from 25% to 40% lower than what they have been paying up to now for the same produce from the North, for the same products from the North. It contends that these duties do it no good and that the money goes back into the pockets of the Northern manufacturers. Therefore, it wants to escape this tax. The suppression of, or even a strong reduction in, these duties would completely ruin the eastern states of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, which could not compete with the cheap prices attained by England and even by France. Thousands of men would find themselves unemployed and would therefore threaten the well-being and the very existence not only of their employers, but even of the merchants and the producers in those areas, leading to an imminent danger of social revolution, which the North must avoid at all costs. This question of tariffs has been discussed in the deliberative assemblies for more than 20 years, and despite the efforts of the South, despite the majority which its supporters in the North gave it, the country has leaned more toward protectionism than toward free trade. Since a Republican president was elected, the South felt that its cause was lost, that the encroachments on its principles would become greater and greater each day under the protection of the federal government. It therefore preferred to fight at once rather than be paralyzed by the measures of this president. In accordance with the theory of the sovereignty of the states, the South declared that since the federal government did not keep the terms of the contract with the South, and threatened its liberties, it had the right to secede, and it did so. Impelled to this extreme decision by ambitious politicians who exploited the passions of the masses to their advantage and who hoped in this way to preserve the power which they lost through the election of the Republican candidate. The North says that certain states have the right to secede if the majority of the states meeting in general convention permits them to do so, but that they cannot do so without this authorization. It says that the Union is one of the principles of the Constitution and that it must be maintained at all costs. And indeed, if it is not, the North would cease to exist as a nation. If the principle of secession is recognized, there are no reasons why, within the two new confederations that would be formed, there should not be an individual secession of dissatisfied states, or within the state itself, a secession of cities or of counties. Anglo-Saxon America would then be reduced to the wretched state reached in Spanish South America by the application of this unfortunate principle. Now, I could go on and on with these letters. These letters are quite interesting, Chair. Quite interesting.
Mike?
So, sir,
Mike,
go
can
ahead.
Can I ask some questions in the middle of this?
Sure, please do.
Here we are 10 months into this tyrannical hoax and lockdown, and really just now we're starting to hear louder voices talking about secession. How long did the South suffer under that tyranny before they came to secession?
30 years. There was a movement for secession under Andrew Jackson. And of course, he denied that the South had the right to secede. But they had the tariff back then, and the tariff was reduced. But there was talks of secession, and that's why in 1832, 1833, you had the great debate on the floor of the Senate between Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun, whichever way you prefer to pronounce it. And that was epic. And in today's world, if you really want to read two giants at the time, political giants, and if you want to hear an exchange of ideas, and just I would have to have been in attendance to have heard these men expound on their beliefs would have been just one of the fantastic experiences in my mind. And we don't even study that today, Terry. No one even talks about that. Well, I elaborated on your question. I hope I answered it.
Yeah, you did, but I mean, it's I certainly don't see this taking 30 years. I think the way that they've escalated things and they're no longer even hiding their corruption and fraud and sedition and treason, they're not even hiding it today. And with the media that we have, with the computers and internet and everything, and people able to be able to really reach a greater number of people, and you see the emotions going up and down, I don't see this taking really much more than another month or two.
Could not disagree with that. I don't think I can offer. As a matter of fact, you know, I've been expecting it almost at any time. I just keep looking for that tripwire. Because I believe that we have established a volatile atmosphere throughout this country, a terribly volatile atmosphere. And I believe that something is going to ignite. I don't know what it's going to be. And usually history will not reveal. You can go back at history, but it's usually something that no one saw coming. And something will ignite it. And I've worried about this, and I've been concerned about this happening. And I truly believe it's going to happen. Something is going to ignite this, and we're going to be in one, as my grandfather used to say, one mail of a Hess here in a short period of time. And I agree with you that I don't think there's that this is going to last or be spread out over a period of time. And You know, and the reason for that is I have never heard so much insanity out of allegedly educated, intelligent people. And I'll give you a prime example, something I heard today. And you know, and everybody who knows me, I really could give a darn less between Trump and you know, I hate Biden. You know, he's just an abject socialist, and he's never done anything except corruption in the 40-some years, he's almost 50 years he's been in politics. But I'm not a Trump fan, so this is not anything political in my statement. But here is the point that just today when I heard this, it's like somebody hits you between the eyes with a hammer and you're going, well, I say heard it, I read it. I was reading about the Supreme Court decision in Wisconsin about the fact that the people, the election people in Wisconsin had sent out a bunch of mail-in ballots strictly against the law, what they had done. Absolutely against the law. So the Supreme Court, and there's seven members in Wisconsin, the Supreme Court meets to vote on whether to have a recount of these to, you know, to take care of these ballots, you know, whatever they were going to do with these ballots, the decision. I didn't read the particulars of the court case, but I read what the Supreme Court said, and it was absolutely absurd. The Supreme Court voted 4-3 to do nothing. What they said was all seven members of the Supreme Court said everything that was done in the election pertaining to those mail-in ballots was illegal. But the majority, the four that voted against the three, said, yes, the rules were violated, but the game is over.
And so, the Chief Justice was one of the three in the dissent, right?
Yes. That is correct. I mean, in what world do you say the rules were violated, the rule book was violated, I think the way they put it, the rule book was violated, but the game is over. It's too late to change anything.
Have you heard the report of the staffer who heard the screaming through the walls when the Supreme Court was in closed door, behind closed door, discussing the Texas lawsuit that was for original jurisdiction with the Supreme Court? Did you hear the report of the staffer?
I did not. I've tried to stay away from as much as that as I could. The absurdity, Terry, just at times it becomes so absolutely ridiculous of what we're going through, is that at any point in time that the judicial branch could tell a state, any one state, I'm not talking about all the ones that joined Texas, but the fact that the Supreme Court could tell any state that they have no standing in the elections that would put a president over them for 4 years. That is,
you need to hear this.
That from Nazi Germany.
You need to hear this. The staffer reported hearing Clarence Thomas and Alito bring up the Bush versus Gore case. And Roberts started screaming at them, I don't want to hear anything about this blankety blank case. There was no riots back then. Back then, there was no riots. In other words, Roberts convinced the majority to vote against taking the Texas case, not because of the rule of law, but because of fear-mongering.
Well, you know, Terry, that troubles me in some respects, because if you are going to be intimidated, if you're a member of the highest court in the country, and you have the ability to be intimidated, you shouldn't be there. And that is one thing I will tell
Amen.
You. Of course, I can tell you, having sat at the same table with Justice Thomas at the Virginia Military Institute when my son was a student there, and his was too, and I approached him at the table sitting at Lejeune Hall at Virginia Military Institute. And he has a really distinctive voice. I mean, it's a, you could call it a booming type voice. And I am sure that if anyone heard him in a group of people, he would be easily discernible. And I give he and Alito credit, but here's the thing. I brought this up on a program today out of Ohio, and here was the thing I made. All three of Trump's appointees voted against him, or against the election part, not against him personally. So,
the only one that voted with him was Alito.
Yes. Well, Thomas, you know, of course.
Let me add one thing to this. I do not for a second accept the fact that Roberts was genuine in his reasoning. I do not believe that he truly made the decision or made the comments that he did out of fear of riots, because there's going to be violence no matter which direction this ends up going. So the violence in the street is inevitable at this point, regardless of which direction, because they have pushed it. And I say they, I'm talking about the very people who were behind the Hazard Circular. They have pushed this to a fever pitch at this point and have set up the perfect storm. We've talked about this here before. But I believe that Roberts made those comments because that was the only way. He couldn't tell the truth that I've been blackmailed, that I've been paid off and bought off, that I'm the corrupt one. He couldn't sit there and give an honest reason for voting against the Texas, taking the Texas case. So he had to fearmonger the other justices. That's my opinion of Roberts.
Well, I agree with that. I thought he was a sellout when he was put on the court to start with. I thought he was owned by the international bankers. And I think so is Kavanaugh, and so are several of the others. That was one of the things that really troubled me when Trump nominated him, and then they did the perfect smoke screen. Then he gets attacked for some kind of sexual innuendo somewhere else, and everyone, and I believe that was done purposely to cover the fact that Kavanaugh was the one that bullied the witnesses in the Vince Foster murder case as the U.S. attorney from Washington, D.C. He bullied and intimidated witnesses to keep that from becoming a murder trial. And so he saved the Clintons. And I believe that's the very reason that Kavanaugh was put there. And I believe that Trump knew it. That, to me, is just the corruption. But we're getting back into that. And I would really like to jump back into the.
I was going to suggest that we get off the sidetrack. So go ahead, please.
All right. Do you have any more questions about those letters?
No, they're awesome. They're so telling. When you bring out this kind of stuff, these original source documents, it just makes things you don't have to sit back and try to figure out what happened. They were there. These are the people who were speaking at the time, and it's so revealing. Thank you very much for bringing them out.
Sure, and one of the things that I put it into a meme on Facebook this week, and here is something for people who are looking at history, and I think this is very, very, very critical. When we look at history, we need to look at these people as they saw themselves in their era of time. We don't need to take these people and judge them by today's era or our standards today. If you're going to understand history, you have to do that. If not, all of your history is going to be perverted. You have to understand why these people acted the way they did in the era that they acted and how they saw themselves. And I think that's extremely critical. But let's lay the groundwork a little bit here. Of course, Lincoln thinks very early on of course, he orders up these troops. But the first thing he does before he orders up troops and before he sends out secret missions to Pensacola, Florida, and to Charleston, South Carolina, and some of his other secret missions, before he does this, he Congress, I want you to convene in July. Now, this is April. I want to call Congress to convene in July, and they convened on July the 4th or the 5th of 1861, I believe. But he told them he wanted to, them to convene then because he had a lot of stuff he wanted to do that he didn't want Congress interfering with. And he didn't want any arguments or any discussion. He was going to get this done. But he believed right off the bat that this war was going to be a 90-day war, max. And he thought that he would just overwhelm the South. And little did he realize that the South had people like Stonewall Jackson. And at that time, when the war started, a private by the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest. He didn't realize the South had these kind of resources. And had Judah P. Benjamin, not Stonewall Jackson, after the Battle of Manassas, First Manassas, if he hadn't stopped him, Stonewall Jackson was set to follow the Yankee army, which was retreating and throwing down their arms. He was set to follow them right into Washington, D.C. and demand and sue for peace. And Judah P. Benjamin put a stop to that. And it was remarkable that from that point forward, and it may have been before, but after that it became known as Stonewall Jackson called Judah P. Benjamin Jefferson Davis's pet Jew. And when Judah P. Benjamin was appointed to be Secretary of War, Stonewall Jackson submitted his resignation. That's documented. But anyway, the war in 1861 through 62 did not go well for the Union at all. Pretty well, we're getting whooped everywhere, and I use that Southern phrase, they were getting whooped wherever they went. Especially in the Shenandoah Valley. Stonewall Jackson had 30-some thousand troops, and he was marching up and down Shenandoah Valley, and he was fighting Shields, Banks, and Fremont, the generals who had over 100,000 men. But the city of Washington, D.C. became so worried about Stonewall Jackson that they started pulling up the planks on the bridges at nighttime because they were afraid Stonewall Jackson was going to march into D.C., so we're into 1862, and the Union Army is suddenly running out of money. They don't have the money to pursue the war, and Lincoln knows he's in trouble. So he and Salmon P. Chase, his Secretary of Treasury, and Salmon P. Chase got the job as Secretary of Treasury because he helped Lincoln get the nomination at the Republican Convention in Chicago. So he is the Secretary of Treasury, and he becomes very dominant and predominant throughout this whole fiasco. So he and Salmon P. Chase and Lincoln realize they've got to come up with some funds. This war is not going to be over, and this war is going to last a lot longer than they thought it would. So they go to the international banking authorities, the Rothschilds. And they say, okay, we need money. We need to borrow some money. And they say, of course, we'll be more than happy to loan you all the money you want, and it will be somewhere between 30 and 40% interest. And Lincoln tells Salmon P. Chase, I can't do that. We cannot do that. So he contacts his friend in Texas, Lincoln does, and his friend tells him, well, hey, just start printing money on the country, on the status of the country. So Lincoln says, yeah, that's a heck of an idea. Lincoln starts printing what was called greenbacks. And the greenbacks were being circulated. There was no interest. You know, the government did not have to pay itself interest on the money it produced itself. Imagine that. did not, so it wasn't putting itself in that kind of debt. So immediately, once this begins to happen, the bankers become quite upset. The international bankers. Hey, suddenly we're losing everything here. You know, we had the opportunity to really make some money off of this war debt, which bankers love wars. That's why they start so damn many of them. But they wanted to have this money. And so here is what we end up, and here I want to read this. I want to read the quote from William Paterson, who started the Bank of England. And here was the quote. He said, "The bank has benefit of interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing." This is 1694. This is the beginning of the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve has today. It has the benefit of interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing. The Federal Reserve creates the money. All of this debt that we have was created out of nothing. But the interest that has to be paid on it has to be paid in specie, has to be paid in hard money. So what the lovely way to go into the whole deal here, just create a bank and loan people money you create out of nothing. But anyway, this is kind of getting away from the Hazard Circular. So this Hazard Circular appears in England. And here it is, and I will quote. It says, "Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power." And chattel slavery abolished. This I and my European friends are in favor of. For slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of labor, while the European plan led on by England is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. So here they're already saying that slavery is a losing proposition because it's labor, but you have to pay for that labor. You know, and people are saying, well, they're not paying salaries, but it says it with the care of labor. Your labor has to be taken care of. So it becomes an expense. And so the bankers do not want that. They want slavery abolished. And so then I'm continuing now with the Hazard Circular. It says the great debt that capitalist, yeah, okay, will see to it is made out of the Civil War must be used to control the value of money. Debt must be used to control the value of money. Wow. To accomplish this, the government bonds must be used as the banking basis. So they've got to get rid of this greenback stuff. They've got to make that worthless. And so here we go on with the Hazard Circular. We are now awaiting for the Secretary of the Treasury, which was Samuel P. Chase, of the United States to make this recommendation. It will not do
so they
to
knew,
allow
they
greenbacks.
Knew in, they knew in advance.
Yes. So it says, it will not do to allow greenbacks, as they are called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that. But we can control the bonds and through them the bank issues. So here we are suddenly with, as the when the war began, you can go back, when the war began, the debt for the United States was somewhere, depending on the source, but the Department of Treasury said it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $80 million. For the United States in 1860. By 1865, the debt is almost $5 billion. So, who profited from this war? to go back to what we said, they knew in advance that Salmon P. Chase was going to make this recommendation. Well, if you read an old, old book called Lincoln Money Martyred, you will find a lot of stories about how this came about. And that was the fact, this book was written in the 1920s, I believe. And so they found out that what happened, and of course you can go back to a book that was written in 1867 by Henry Clay Dean. There's a book written back there that also verifies this. So this is verifiable through several sources. And Henry Clay Dean was an interesting person indeed. He had been put in prison by Lincoln. He was a preacher and a judge. And I believe he was from Iowa. And he had been put in prison by Lincoln for questioning Lincoln's authority to use all of his war powers. And so he had been put in prison without a trial, without due process, without all that other stuff. You know, put him in jail first, due process second. Oh, gosh, I believe somebody said that recently. But anyway, that was the deal. What had happened, according to these accounts, is that the bankers come to Salmon P. Chase with about $500,000. And they say, look, here, spread this money among the Congress. Buy as many people as you need to make sure we get rid of the greenback so that the United States at that time will have to borrow this money from us. So we've got to get rid of your greenback. So what happens in late 1862? The Currency Act of 1862, which makes the greenback, you can still have all the greenbacks you want, pay a debt with them. So that is the Currency Act of 1862. Then they follow it up with another Currency Act in 1863, which establishes all of this debt for the wonderful bankers in England, the Bank of England. Gives an insight into what was going on that isn't taught anywhere, Terry. Have any questions so far?
No, I'm just following along here. So I can't contribute to that. I think it's very obvious what's going on. If I'm just hoping people grasp this concept of capital controlling labor. I hope somebody's thinking minimum wage about right now.
Well, as a matter of fact, this crazy guy that you know, the one that's called the Rebel Madman, he wrote an article on this, and I will actually go over this paragraph again since you mentioned that. And it goes back to the Hazard Circular. Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery abolished. This I and my European friends are in favor of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of labor, while the European plan led on by the England is the capital shall control labor by controlling wages, parentheses, minimum wage, anyone. So I put this in my article way back when. So then, also reading from my article at this time, I said, we can discern from the Hazard Circular that Secretary Chase was being manipulated or controlled by the banking cabal of the Bank of England. While there are those on the left and the right who deny the existence of this circular and the cabal's control of Chase, and by default, the control of Abraham Lincoln, we must ask ourselves, did the events as predicted in the circular actually occur? Facts are indeed history. Secretary Chase proposed and supported, I had my years wrong, I apologize for that. Secretary Chase proposed and supported the National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864. So then Secretary Chase, realizing the necessity of collecting taxes in order to continue the war of aggression on the people and the property of the South, also created the Bureau of Internal Revenue, for what we commonly refer to today as the IRS. Now, you wonder at what point did the bankers maybe desert Chase. They had used him because Chase was greatly ambitious, and he actually challenged Lincoln for the presidency in 1864 and ran again for president in 1868 and in 1872 while sitting as the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Another one of those crazy facts from history.
And if you were to ask people, has a Supreme Court justice ever run for president, you'd get a no answer on that one.
And they would be wrong three times. Well, at least twice, 68 and 72. So it says Chase would use his position on the Supreme Court to further the interest of the banking cabal, especially in Texas v. White. Chase, as Chief Justice, also presided over the impeachment trial of President Andrew Johnson, whom the radical Republicans who supported Reconstruction schemed to impeach in part because Johnson called the Reconstruction Act of 1867, and I quote, a bill of attainder against 9 million people, an absolute despotism. Such a power has not been wielded by any monarch in England for over 500 years. In Texas v. White, Chase contemplated of the Constitutional Republic as established in 1788, the 9th and 10th Amendments of 1791, and obliterated the consent of the governed clause of the Declaration of Independence of 1776. Chase converted the free and independent states of our founders to the highly centralized and controlled government of oppression we have today.
Since Scorpio is not here to ask the question, most people are not going to know what a bill of attainder is, but I'll let you correct me. Let me put it that way. A bill of attainder is where government is able to implement punishment upon someone without due process. Would you agree with that?
That's a perfect definition. That's exactly it. You declare someone guilty or a group of people guilty without a trial. So, yes, that is the perfect definition, Terry, and thanks for bringing that up. Sometimes when I'm skimming over these things, I don't stop to think that people may not have understood what a bill of attainder was, and I thank you for mentioning that. So, and in today's world, if you, you know, I'm not sure if it's still on tests for bar exams, but Texas v. White is often used to claim that there is no right to secession. And I'm sure we're going to hear that again soon. If some state actually starts pushing this to the legal boundaries on secession, we're going to hear Texas v. White, and I would highly recommend that people really learn about Texas v. White if you're going to think about secession, because this is going to come up. Because in that, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Salmon P. Chase, ruled that this country is, and I quote, an indestructible union of indestructible states. We'll use because it's precedent, but study that case, because that case is unreal the way that because under the Reconstruction Act, Texas was not a state, and yet the Supreme Court had a ruling over a state that wasn't a state. So it becomes quite a
let that one some we might have to let that one marinate.
Well, you know, look, they did the same thing as we talked about earlier. They did the same thing with under the 14th Amendment. The federal government said under the 14th Amendment that the 10 southern states must ratify the 14th Amendment before they could be admitted to the Union. Well, if you're not a state, how do you ratify an amendment to the Constitution? That would be like today. They had kicked under the Reconstruction Act of 1867. The 10 southern states had been kicked out of the Union. They couldn't kick out Tennessee because the president was from Tennessee. So they couldn't kick Tennessee out with the other southern states, because then they would have had a president from a foreign country or a foreign territory. So they didn't. That's the reason that Tennessee was not kicked out of the Union under the Reconstruction Act. And so the 10 states were kicked out of the Union, and they were told the only way to come back into the Union, they had to ratify the 14th Amendment. Well, if you're not a state, how can you ratify anything? So when you get into the absurdities, and we look at the absurdity of the courts today, the courts have been absurd since 1789. Some of the stupid decisions in the Alien and Sedition Act, with a Supreme Court justice who actually ran the prosecution off in one case, ran the defense team off in one case, and then became the judge and the defense prosecution in the same case. So if you don't think this judicial system has been absurd, and when people say, oh, well, you know, the Constitution protects, how did the Constitution didn't protect anybody? It hasn't protected any of these people. When the government decides it's going after you.
I don't want to sidetrack you, but why is it that people believe equal protection under the law originated with the 14th Amendment? If you've got an impartial judiciary making right rulings, which is what they're supposed to do, why would there not have been equal protection under the law all along? But today we're hearing this as a part of, for example, the Supreme Court denying standing to Texas. One of the things you're hearing is that they have failed to give Texas equal protection under the law. Can you respond to that, Mike, or is it not something you want to get into?
No, I don't mind at all. It's the reason that they wanted to throw that equal thing out there and to be able to use it in any way they wanted to was because, you know, the whole race issue at the end of the war. Of course, it was these crazy Southerners who were not going to give the black folks rights. You know, so they come out with the 13th Amendment, which says that everybody's equal. We're all equal. Everything is fine. And it gives in the South, it's mandated that black males can vote. Of course, I've always said, well, you know, why couldn't females vote? You know, we had to wait, 80 years for females to be able to vote? And where is that equal protection under the law? This thing has been a farce and a joke for most of its existence. People just can't accept that, can't wrap their head around it. But why should, suddenly it take 80 years before the women are allowed to vote in this country? Is that equal protection for the women? Were the women worse than slaves? Because the people who were formerly slaves, at least the males, were allowed to vote. It was mandated that they could vote. But, Terry, why did we have the 15th Amendment? If the 13th Amendment made everybody equal, why did they have to have the 15th Amendment?
Well, it wasn't properly ratified, so somebody didn't like it very well.
Well, there was a reason that the 15th Amendment was even proposed. Do you know what that was?
I'll let you go for that one.
Okay, because the blacks were voting in the South, but the northern states wouldn't allow them to vote. So they had to get an amendment to the Constitution so the blacks could vote in the North. Farce of this whole thing is beyond comprehension. It, you know, when we look at this, we look at the fiasco of this whole thing is that, you know, and just this week I pointed out to someone, you know, Kentucky was in the Union, right? It was a border state, but it was in the Union. Do you know when Lincoln brought up the Emancipation Proclamation, the legislature of the state of Kentucky voted unanimously not to adhere to it? And then when the 13th Amendment was proposed, Kentucky said no. Kentucky refused to go along with it. And yet we're told that the war was about slavery. And all of the border states inside of the Union that stayed in the Union all had slaves. That's why the 13th Amendment only freed the slaves in the South, didn't free the slaves in the border states. Because if they did, Lincoln was afraid the border states would secede and join the South. So it wasn't about slavery, people. You know, gosh, wake up. If it was about slavery, why was West Virginia allowed to join the Union as a slave state in 1864? War's been going on for 3 years. And you admit a state into the Union as a slave state? That's a year after the Emancipation Proclamation. Come on, people, think. I'm sorry. This stuff kind of upsets me at times, Terry.
Well, it's just true. I mean, they've mistaught or distaught the history so severely that people don't know these things. And when you bring it out, it's like rather shocking, honestly.
Well, I've discovered something in the past few days, Terry, and of course I discovered it a long time ago. And here is the thing, and I please bear with me if I sound egotistical. But I have spent the better part of 30 years researching history. Source documents, that's been where I go to for my information. Source documents. I've sat hours in the Library of Congress, in the National Archives, and I have looked at these documents. I've made copies of them. I have a lot of the copies of these documents. I have gone to the library at the University of Virginia and sat in there and looked at documents over and over and over again, there in Monticello, and looked at documents, looked at source documents of history. And yet today I have people who believe they know more than I do because they went to had a history class in high school and because their emotions tell them that I'm wrong. In America, the facts mean nothing. It's how you feel about it. And I've had two instances today where people have basically said to me, well, you know, that's your opinion. No, it's not my opinion. Here it is, the source document. Well, that may be, but I think so-and-so. I feel so-and-so. Yeah, okay, well, sorry. So that's why we're in the mess we're in, is because the truth doesn't matter. It's how do you feel about this? And so we've been destroyed. And as I made the point today on the show with the good old Jim Ram, the whole thing is, regardless of how we want to look at this, America has, as Thomas Jefferson said, the people get the government they deserve. And we deserve it, and we're getting it. A big, full blast right in the mouth. What, did I put you to sleep?
No, it's just, you know, it's just reality. The people that believe the lies are the ones that are truly responsible. They cannot blame the tyrants when they have abdicated and accepted the lies of the tyrants. I mean, look at all the idiots walking around wearing masks that do not stop a virus. All they do is dumb people down. It's like you said back in March or April. Well, the one thing about the mask is we don't need to give anybody an IQ test. There are people who actually believe, there are people out there who actually believe that the vaccine is going to cure the virus when the virus is a hoax.
Terry, they don't know it. They hope it, because that is what people deal on. They
and
deal
that's what
on
they
hope.
Say. When you try to give them facts, they say, literally, I've had them say it to me in the last 2 days, don't take my hope away.
Yeah. Well, here's the simple thing is, you know, hope is not a course of action, nor is it a force multiplier. And when people use that word today, hope is an emotion. It's all about hope. It's a total emotion. And when I think about that, I think about Patrick Henry at St. John's Church. When he said, we will listen to the siren song of hope until we are all turned into beasts. Look at the way people are acting. Because they're listening to the siren song of hope. You know, I hope I win the lottery. But then, you know, people tell me, at least my wife tells me, well, you know, you have to buy a ticket. And I've never bought one. So I guess I'm not going to win the lottery. But it's hope. Hope is an emotion. If you can hook people on emotions, reason will never matter to them anymore. I see it every day. Once they're hooked on that emotional hook, logic, reason, and facts are just, you know, they're puffs of wind. They're gone. They don't matter anymore. What can we hope for? What can we wish for? What can I employ my emotions on? Because my brain doesn't work anymore. Deprived of oxygen. It's just a wet mass in my head. But I'm hoping. Pardon me. I'll let you talk for a while, Terry.
Oh no, that's right on, Mike. This hazard circular. I just want people to understand that this is precisely what we're looking at today. We gave these people control. We made the banksters more powerful than our government, and we have allowed them to continue to charge us interest on a fraudulent debt and use a currency system that the devaluation of the purchasing power of that currency is a bigger tax than we pay in taxes. And it is a theft of the people's production, and it goes all the way back to the Hazard Circular, and as you said, apparently 30 years before the war between the states, or the war of Northern Aggression, or Second Revolution. It's continued to today, and now we've allowed them to even escalate the lie to the point of convincing us, without increasing the number of deaths out there, that people have to be so afraid they can't open their business. Talk about insanity. It is,
well, Terry,
insane.
Because I'm looking for that tripwire. And here is one point that I saw that I dug up that maybe we may see something here very shortly. And that is that when Congress brought down this pandemic fiasco, they put this thing out there that said, okay, you folks who are out of work, you can't be evicted from your home. If you can't pay your rent, you can't be evicted from your apartment or your home, whatever it is, you cannot, that you just can't do that. We're not going to allow that. You know, if you can't pay for it, you know, we're just not going to kick you out, because this thing is going to be fixed in just a few months. Now, this is what they were saying in March and April. It's not going to be that long. Things will be fine. You can't be kicked out of your homes. There are today, Terry, somewhere between 5 and 7 million families in this country
who are subject to eviction January 1.
Who are on the 1st of January, because that is when it expires. And I believe it was set to the 1st of January for a reason. It's just like this. They're playing back and forth with the stimulus money. They're playing these games to put people hard up against it. So when these people who own this property, who own these homes, who own these apartments, and they've been getting no income themselves from their own property, that, again, is a theft by the government that never should have been allowed to happen. Because you not only you rob the people who own property, you rob them of their ability to make money on their own property. So if that ends on 1 January, if there is no stimulus, if suddenly there's no money, the unemployment thing has dried up to where initially they were paying people $600 a week not to work. You notice that hadn't been extended. This whole thing is running down to a funnel point, Terry, economically. And we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 to 300,000 small businesses that will never reopen again. That means all of the money that those people put into their blood, sweat, and tears into a business, small business, which was the backbone of America, that we're going to lose those. They will never open again. So this thing is coming to a head, and I believe it's been intentionally channeled that way. And if suddenly 5 to 7 million families are told, okay, here you go, out in the street, there you go, sorry, because your grace period is now over, where are they going to go, Terry? What are going to be the ramifications of that? Do you think there might be some angry there somewhere? And that's why your point that these riots are coming, and, you know, John Roberts can say whatever he wants to intimidate people, but these riots are coming. If all of that was going on, and I have no doubt that it was, the fact that the only two people who would stand up to him were Alito and Thomas tells us that we have seven people on there, and, you know, I don't know how many women there are, but the rest of them are geldings. Or capons in the chicken world, I think. Put you to sleep again?
No. No. It's just that, these comments that you make make my brain start spinning, and I don't want to start bloviating here, which would be real easy for me to do. So,
well, we're headed into uncharted territory, and it don't look good. I see it in so many ways, and, you know, just one of the things, I don't know if other people, you know, somebody, you folks stop and think about this, but one of the things I've noticed is that people driving on the highways are turning insane. And I've wondered how much of this is coming about from a lack of oxygen, or just the fact the world is going insane. I mean, I've seen some things happen in the past month and a half of people that you just, you look at people when they're driving and they do stupid things and you go, of course, people have been doing stupid things driving for a long time, but not in the numbers they're doing them now. It's just absolutely amazing. Because who stops on an interstate? Who comes to a complete stop in a lane where the speed limit's 75 miles an hour to let someone enter the interstate from a ramp? I saw that last week. I've seen things that just do not make any sense. And I really believe that we are, that the people's minds have been played by this psyop to the point, and we're talking about the hope thing that you mentioned, we're looking at a very scary scenario coming here. And where is the tripwire? You know, the thing we talk about with, in April 19th, 1775, the shot heard around the world. We don't know who fired it. Who was the person that pulled that trigger that started the Revolutionary War? Which side were they on? Were they even involved in the battle between Major John Pitcairn and the Minutemen? There's a mindset out there that's really scaring me about as much as anything when you see people are just doing stuff that doesn't make sense anymore.
When was the last time somebody tried to give you incorrect change?
Well,
the cashiers right now are all walking around with only half a brain because they're deprived of oxygen.
Well, I'm not sure they had a lot to start with.
You won't get an argument out of me on that one, but I do believe that it's worse now than it ever has been.
Well, I remember several years ago when I went into a sub shop in Tucson, Arizona, with my daughter and my mother-in-law, God rest her soul, and we went in and we bought something, and I handed $13.26 or something like that, and I handed the cashier a 20, and they had a power outage, and she's trying to figure out how to make my change, and I said, just give me $6.74 and that'll be fine. And she says, how do you know that? And I said, it's called addition and subtraction. And she says, well, I can't do that. If the machine doesn't say that, I can't do that. And Terry, in all honesty, this had to be 1997, 1998, somewhere in there. In all honesty, they had to go two levels of management to figure out how much money to give me in change.
Well, so you're talking to a guy who grew up in his family's grocery store, and at age 7, on the old cash registers, no scanners, no calculator in it, it just tallied up the total for you by punching in the amount for each one, and you had to figure out the change yourself. Well, at age 7, I was proficient on the old cash register during a rush time of the store, and had change artists trying to come and trick me to get me to give them too much change. And at age 7, I'd put a stop to it. So I don't get where these people are coming from today, because that's just not a world I've lived in.
Well, stop and think of something else, Terry. Do you remember when you bought something, people would count your change back to you?
That's what we did. And we never put the money away. We never put the money away that they handed to us until after they were satisfied with it, what was counted back to them.
That's the way you did it. Oh, let me ask you a quick question before we get into it here. We're not doing a show next week, are we?
let's not.
Well, that was my idea. I was going to tell you, you're going to have to do that one by yourself. It's Christmas Eve, and I'm going to be with my grandkid.
Well, and you know that I'm hitting the road 2 days after that, so.
Yeah,
the Civil War hasn't started by then.
Well, yeah, I've heard a rumor about where you're going too. I'm not sure, but I've heard a rumor.
Yep. So I'm hoping things that we can still travel state to state come that week.
Well,
I'm
hoping that as well. I'm hoping that as well, although I'm not planning on traveling. I'm hoping that works out for you, my friend.
Thank you. We've got about 5 minutes left. Have you kind of finished your thoughts on the Hazard Circular?
Yes, sir, I have.
Well, this has been a good lesson. I really appreciate the source documents. I keep saying it over and over, but I can't really say it enough because, you know, the textbooks don't reveal source documents very often. Once in a while you see something. Well, maybe that's a good way for you to spend the next 4 minutes talking about
it. Well, the thing I'll tell you this is that if you're going to write a lie into a history book, you don't want to put a source document in there that proves you're lying.
Well, one of the objections that I've had to a lot of authors writing about somebody else's life is that they try to interpret what they meant. And frequently they really didn't get the idea of what was really going on. It's like taking scripture out of context. And that's the way I view a lot of the textbooks, is that they take so many things out of context and it really points to the agenda behind whoever's writing it. And without going to the source documents, how can we ever know what's true?
Well, Terry, that's the reason I'm working on my book. And the book I'm working on, and it's titled A Bill of Rights or A Bill of Goods. And that is what I am doing. My entire basis for that book is 141 letters involved in the Congress and with various other people outside, like the senators writing to Patrick Henry back in Virginia. The two Virginia senators letting him know what's going on. I am basing this entire book on 140 some letters between the founders. I call them the founders, the people who put together the Bill of Rights and ancillary folks involved in the process. And so I believe that these letters tell the story. I don't need to tell the story. I just need to put the link of how this goes to this one and how this one said this and how they countered this one said this, that is the same thing about in a different way, and to point those out. And the letters, and especially to show the difference in the letters from March of 1789, when the first Congress convened, until September of 1789, when the Bill of Rights was completed and sent to the states. And how the attitudes changed of the people who were involved. That is where the story is. It's not what I think about the Bill of Rights. The story is what did these people who were doing it, what did they think? What did they see? What did they feel? And, you know, when you have someone like Richard Henry Lee who tells Patrick Henry, the only reason I agreed to be a senator was to protect the rights of the people. The only reason, can you even imagine somebody saying that today?
Well, I've heard some say it, but it was nothing more than rhetoric.
Well, his actions back
up what they wanted to hear.
Richard Henry Lee's actions back him up. And when William Grayson writes to Patrick Henry at the end of September, like September 27th of 1789, and he says in his letter, this is exactly what I thought we would get by agreeing to do the after game. In other words, we agreed to put the Bill of Rights on afterwards. This is exactly what I thought would happen, and this Bill of Rights will bring more harm than good. When were we ever taught that? That a senator who was involved in it says this Bill of Rights, they have stretched the English language. They have changed. They have manipulated. They have done everything to make sure the people have no rights. When were we ever taught that?
Mike,
and I can't be the first person
you're
that
writing,
ever taught it.
Your writing from 6 or 7 years ago has changed. Because even though you were approaching that level of knowledge, you're different. You're writing different today than you were then. Because you go back and look at some of your past articles, and you can see that you have gained. You've not stopped learning. You're still grasping. You're still studying those source documents, and it's changing you.
Yes, I realize that, and if I didn't. I mean, what I wrote 6 or 7 years ago, and I wrote some stuff 11 years ago, which was prophetic, and I've also written some articles where I have supported the Bill of Rights and said if we would only go by that. And you're right, and thank you for your compliment, because I consider that a compliment, because I have found more documents, and I said history is like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You never get the true picture till you have all the pieces.
Mike, rather than playing music to close us out, I would love it if you would say a minute and a half prayer for us. We're out of time.
You know, Terry, mine, I guess we could call them prayers, but mine are conversations. And it's just, you know, and it's the conversations I have, and it's just, dear Lord, please step up for us, although we're undeserving. But step up and take care of the people, because the people have lost their way. We know that now that the depredations that we have created for ourselves, that we're not going to be able to fix them. They're just going to get worse. As we move along, they will just be worse. They're not going to get better. And so we ask for your intervention, Lord. We ask that you step up and help us, put us back on the path. And those who you can use us to accomplish your goals. And we ask all of this in your name.
Amen. Good night, everyone. And we'll see you in 2 weeks, not next week, but the following Thursday night on Handling the Truth. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate you a lot, brother.
You too, buddy. Take care, buddy.